Welcome to Sound Bites, hosted by registered dietitian nutritionist Melissa Joy Dobbins.
Welcome back to the Sound Bites podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the show. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to share a few quick updates with you. First of all, the book Tomorrow's Table that we talk about today in the episode, the second edition is now available, so look for that. Also, my guest, Pamela Ronald, appears in the movie Food Evolution, which is a new documentary by Academy Award nominated director Scott Hamilton Kennedy, and it's narrated by Neil deGrasse Tyson. So I'm going to put some links in my show notes at soundbitesrd.com to find out where you might see a screening in your neck of the woods, or how you can just tune in yourself and purchase it on Amazon or iTunes, Hulu, Google Play, and even YouTube. So I haven't seen it yet myself, but I'm really excited to see it. It looks like it's going to be really great. And in this age of shockumentaries, I think it's time that we had something that has a little bit more science and evidence to it. So I also wanted to let you know that I recently attended the Produce for Better Health Conference, and I want to really emphasize the importance, you know, whether you're a fellow dietitian or you are a non-dietitian and you're listening to the show, I really want to emphasize that all forms of fruits and vegetables not only count towards your daily serving, but they're good choices. So that means all forms and all kinds. So it doesn't have to be fresh. It doesn't have to be organic. It can be frozen, dried, canned, juices, conventional, organic, GMO, all of it counts, and you don't need to worry about pesticides. You know, the Dirty Dozen recently came out with their new list and their new, you know, scare tactics. But, and actually, I've done a lot of sharing on social media to try to combat their fear-mongering. But, you know, you can go to this very credible resource for more information, including a pesticide residue calculator. So go to safefruitsandveggies.com for more information about all of that. If you're concerned about pesticide residues on fruits and vegetables, or you want to know what to tell your patients and clients. Also, I am getting ready to head out on my speaking circuit. So if you're in Fargo, North Dakota, Kennewick, Washington, or Los Angeles area planning to go to the California Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics meeting, let me know. Shoot me an email at melissa@soundbitesrd.com or just give me a shout out on social media and maybe we can meet up and say hi. Also, if you're a dietitian, if you are coming to Today's Dietitian in Austin, which I hope you are, give me a shout out or shoot me an email because I'm trying to arrange a Soundbites podcast meetup. When I was at the Produce for Better Health conference, we did a group photo of all of the people who are attending the conference who've actually been on my podcast before. So I would love to do that again. So that was a lot of fun. Also, just a few updates on Today's Dietitian and our partnership. There are two recently recorded webinars that are free that you might want to check out. The first is Eating Beyond the Headlines with Neva Cochran, and the second one is Family Meals Matter, Barriers, Benefits, and Strategies for Eating Together with Liz Weiss. So check those out. Also, if you haven't checked out the RD Lounge blog recently, there are a few really great articles recently on Diabetes Management in Children by Kimberly Wolf, Eating Vegetarian on the Go by Ginger Holton, and Writing a Book Proposal by Toby Amador. And just one more quick thing, the next episode is going to be with Laura Kuman, who is the author of the Hamilton Cookbook. So that is an episode you don't want to miss. So I really hope you enjoyed today's show and give me any feedback you have on social media, post a comment in the show notes, or send me an email at melissa@soundbitesrd.com. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to the Sound Bites podcast. I'm your host, Melissa Joy Dobbins, a registered dietitian nutritionist. And on my show, I delve into the science, the psychology, and the strategies behind good food and nutrition. And I do that by inviting guests on my show to kind of have some conversations about these topics and explore some of our thoughts and feelings about these different areas of food and nutrition. And today I am really excited to bring on an author and the distinguished professor at the University of California, Davis, Pamela Ronald. You are not only a distinguished professor at UC Davis, but you're the director of the Institute for Food and Agricultural Literacy. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Thank you very much, Melissa. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I am so grateful that you took time out of your crazy busy schedule to talk with me. You are the author of Tomorrow's Table, and you co-authored this book with your husband, and is a very interesting story that we're going to get into. But in addition to that, I want to share with people a little bit more about you. You were selected in 2015 by the Scientific American as one of the world's 100 most influential people in biotechnology, and by Grist magazine as an innovator who will lead us toward a more sustainable future. And they also refer to you as the Rice Whisperer, which we'll get into. So you co-authored this book, Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food, with your husband. You are a plant geneticist, and your husband, Raul Adamczak, is an organic farmer. Now, my regular listeners will know I have brought your book up on the show many, many times. And so it's just sort of like coming full circle to have you on the show, because you may not remember, but I saw you speak. I don't know. I'm pretty sure I went up and spoke to you afterwards, but I saw you present at a conference in Vancouver in 2013, and I got a signed copy of your book. But that was the first time that I had ever heard this concept of it's not one or the other. Let's bring all tools together at the table and work together. And it was just such a, you know, kind of a game changer. So thank you for that. And we're going to talk more about your book and the work that you do, that you've been doing, and sort of this passion, this labor of love, this life's work passion that you have. But I'm going to stop talking and start asking questions. I think the first place I want to start is, how did the book come about? And maybe backing up, how did you and your husband meet? I want to say the foreword of your book is wonderful, because it starts, "This book is a tale of two marriages. The first is that of Raul and Pam, the authors, and is a tale of the passions of an organic farmer and a plant genetic scientist." So, how did this come about? And backing up, like, how did you even meet your husband?
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for the work you do. I met my husband on his farm, actually. We have a mutual friend, and his farm was on a river. And we went out there that day because he was going to teach her how to roll a kayak.
What does that mean?
Oh, so we live in the Central Valley of California. There's many rivers that come down from the Sierra Nevada down from, 8,000 feet down to the valley. And there are rapids. And so people put kayaks in rapids, and often you flip upside down, which is very unpleasant.
Yeah.
And so that you do a flick with your paddle and your hips, and you can flick the kayak back up, and he's very good at that, and so he was going to teach her.
And was it love at first sight?
We really liked each other very much, and we went for a walk, we looked at flowers, and it was very nice.
And at what point did you think, I'm interested in plant genetics, he's doing organic farming? That's not weird, because you talk a lot in your work about shared values and common ground. So did that ever seem like a strange marriage?
No, it never entered our minds at all. I mean, we met many years ago now, and I think it was before there was much interest in farming, and before there was much interest in plant genetics. And he has a science background, and I've worked on briefly on an organic farm. So we never thought that it was anything strange about it, because farmers use seed and are very interested in different kinds of seed varieties.
So from the beginning, there was never anything that you both felt like these shared interests, this common understanding, because there is a lot of science in agriculture. And but from an outside perspective, this seems so strange.
Yeah, that's funny. No, we both love the wilderness, and we went on backcountry ski trips together, and we love food and farming, and we never occurred to us that anybody would even pay attention.
Hmm. And at what point, when maybe the whole farm-to-table movement or organic started becoming more popular, when was that point where you kind of realized, oh, people don't really understand this? They see these as mutually exclusive or opposing approaches, and they've got it all wrong. And I want to clear this up. And I think a book is the way to do that.
Well, I think what happened was quite a few number of years ago now, maybe 15 years ago, we started noticing that we would go to parties and people were more and more interested in farming, first of all, and they were more interested in genetics. And we started to notice that there was sort of fear of modern plant genetics, and there was a lot of trust in organic farmers. So Raul often would explain the genetics to our friends and family. And it, you know, it was very interesting to notice, one, that there was so much interest, and two, that there was so much curiosity learning from a farmer rather than a scientist. So I think it was the first time I realized that there's maybe something about the scientific profession that people find off-putting. And I, of course, never thought about that either. And then there was a number of newspaper articles that wrote about organic farming or plant genetics or farming that were always just a little bit off. They didn't quite explain things very well, we thought, to the audience. And then there was even a story about us once that we thought, they kind of missed the information, knowledge transfer there. And in the end, we just thought, oh, well, you know, if we're going to talk about food, farming, and genetics, we might as well just, maybe people want to hear it from the people that are doing the work.
Wonderful. And your book came out in 2008. And I should say the second edition is coming out March of 2018. So we are going to be looking out for that. And, you know, interested in all the updates. So did you get much of a good reception when the book first came out? And maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit too much. How was it writing a book with your husband? And that's more where I should go.
Well, it was really fun, because it's almost like you're dating a different person. So instead of dating married to a farmer, I was now married to a writer. So it was very romantic. And that lasted for a while until we started critiquing each other's pieces. And then we had to be very sensitive. You have to be extra sensitive when it's your husband that you're making suggestions to, compared to your students that are used to you doing it, so much editing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Everything becomes a little nitpicky criticism. I can't do anything right. Can't wash the dishes right. Can't edit this chapter right. Right. So there's quite a bit of information in the book. I have to say, with all due respect, it's not a quick read. It's a very good book. I like that there's even a few recipes sprinkled out throughout here and there. But this book sort of seems, as I've been doing my research on you and kind of looking at the work that you've been doing, would it be fair to say that this book sort of explains, you know, the foundation for you is regarding your work with rice, which I want to talk about, because it's obviously very important to you and to the world, and gets into, like, what is organic agriculture? What is genetic engineering? Who do we trust? It touches on the environment, seed ownership, but there's just so much personality and personal experience throughout the book. What do you want people to know about the book, and why they might want to buy it and read it?
So we wrote the book for really people that are interested in how food is produced and what are the modern plant genetic methods and what does the term GMO really mean for the future of our planet and the health of families. So that is one of the points that we hope people will get out of the book, would satisfy people's curiosity. I think also wanted to get people excited about science and what scientists do and the scientific method. And then we rouse a lot of descriptions of his farm and his vegetables. And partly we wanted to bring people into the joy of our professions and communicate that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you do that. You did a good job with that, I have to say. I also wanted to mention that Bill Gates calls your book a fantastic piece of work. I want to talk to you about your work with rice, and you have so many wonderful examples. You did a TED Talk in March of 2015, How Genetic Engineering Can Fight Disease, Reduce Insecticide Use, and Enhance Food Security. And there's some really great, like Fast Company said, the question to ask about a new crop, says Pamela Ronald, is not, is it GM or genetically modified, but can it help food security in less developed nations? And I think that gets to the whole sort of motivation of your research with rice is to help feed the world. And so I want you to talk about that a little bit. I know that, again, that's a big focus of your work, but let's talk about rice and why you're the rice whisperer.
So I was drawn to rice when I was beginning to establish my own research direction because rice is a staple food for half the world's people. And I wanted to work on an important crop. And the hope was that I could contribute somehow to farmers and their families, subsistence farmers and their families that are growing only enough food to feed themselves and their families. So that's one reason I was very interested in working on rice. And if you can make just small changes in resistance to disease or tolerant to environmental stress, you can potentially have a beneficial impact on millions of people.
Yes. And actually, I want to take a step back. The term GMO, genetically modified organism, is the acceptable term. You explain, as well as I've heard before by others, is like it's not actually technically correct. It's GE, genetic engineering. Can you speak to that a little bit? I think I got into this when I had Greg Jaffe on the podcast talking about GMOs, but I think it bears repeating. We kind of, again, use that term because it's kind of widely accepted, but it's not accurate and it's not maybe, I don't even know that GE is the best term to use, but can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I think the term GMO is problematic because it doesn't really explain. It sort of deadens the discussion immediately because people have different ideas of what that means. So everything we eat is genetically altered using some type of genetic approach. I think the only exceptions maybe are wild blueberries or if you're hunting mushrooms or catching wild salmon. But almost everything we eat, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, has been genetically altered. Some crops for over 10,000 years. So the Food and Drug Administration doesn't use the term GMO because it doesn't explain exactly what that food is. So I think most of the sort of visceral concern comes from the idea of putting, for example, bacterial genes into a plant or a viral gene into a plant. And that technique is called genetic engineering or transgenics. So there, there's a couple other words that people commonly use. So what I like to talk about is the plant itself, or perhaps talk about the process. But I think it's hard to have a discussion about GMOs because it's so ill-defined. It's hard to advance the conversation.
Right. Yes. And I think, the terminology that we use is important. I think there's so much miscommunication and misunderstanding. And I think that's inherently an issue with science because there's technical jargon, just like with any industry. But with science in particular, I think it's just hard for people to understand obviously, as a dietitian, having worked in a clinical medical setting and in my training, focusing on that as well, you know, learning that you can't talk to a patient or a client with the same medical terminology that you need to put in the medical chart and that you're speaking to your colleagues and your, you know, the physicians about, because they won't understand it. You have to put it into layman's terms. So I think that that in and of itself is a problem. But I love this quote from you. You say, science is not a belief system. My opinion doesn't matter. Let's look at the evidence. And I believe that's from your TED Talk, which was fabulous, by the way. So let's talk about, because I want to touch on the words we use a little bit later, but let's talk about that aspect, like the facts versus the feelings, opinions versus evidence, because I think that you deal with this day in and day out.
Yeah. So there are a few sort of scientific issues that really bring up a lot of emotions in people. And sometimes they make decisions not based on evidence, but more based on what their feelings are, or they maybe read something that confirmed their beliefs rather than thinking about the science. Or often we don't provide, as scientists, I think we've done a poor job of, in some cases, making it accessible. So that, you know, kind of some of the hot topics are vaccines, genetically improved crops, climate change, evolution. These are sort of the emotional scientific topics. And it's quite interesting when you think that there's an infinite number of scientific issues that one could think a lot about, but these are the ones that are, I think, most topical, at least right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. What scares you the most about arguments and resistance around genetic engineering?
Well, I think what worries me is that the people that most need access to modern crop varieties may not have access because of sort of the fears and policies of very wealthy countries who actually do have enough to eat.
Now, you've been referred to as the scientist most likely or most widely known for defending genetically engineered crops. There's a lot of, I want to talk about like activists and politics. You know, you mentioned policies and it makes me think of politics. Let's talk about activists and how or does politics play into this whole conversation?
Well, I would not like to be necessarily known as the GMO lady, but I have heard that because I actually, since I don't like the term, I sort of feel this sort of pro-GMO, non-GMO, or no GMO is just goes nowhere. And so what my husband and I, we like to think of ourselves as pro-sustainable agriculture, and we're open to any appropriate technology that will advance sustainable agriculture and enhance food security. So I would like to be known in that way, but I, of course, do feel that some applications of modern plant genetics are very useful, as we've seen. So in terms of politics, what specifically are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about the activists and how, you know, I like to say in my work a lot, you know, the loudest voices are usually not the most credible voices. And, you know, there's a difference between kind of having a conversation about different viewpoints and different potential solutions and learning from other people. And then you've got this extreme activism that seems just completely biased, and, you know, it flies in the face of science and evidence, yet it's so emotional and it's so extreme. So obviously, with regard to genetic engineering, there are a lot of people who don't understand it. I can't even say that I understand it, but I come from, you know, you mentioned like reading stuff that confirms your thoughts or your feelings, and that's confirmation bias. I did my graduate research in biotechnology. So even though I don't understand genetic engineering, I can sort of follow along when it's being explained to me, but I couldn't explain it to somebody else very well. I trust the science. that's my bias. I'm biased towards that because I've been exposed to that in my education, in my research, and in my field. So that's kind of a roundabout way of saying, you know, just I know that activists and kind of getting back to the emotion part, you know, that has been a huge part of the conversation. And I think it's been a huge barrier in getting people to be open to hearing the science and the evidence about this technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we try to do in the book is explain the scientific process and talk about what scientific consensus means. So we, in terms of the process of genetic engineering, and we could talk about that if you like, but the process of genetic engineering, every major scientific organization in the world has concluded that the process of genetic engineering is no more risky than other types of plant breeding. And when we make a statement at that, like that, it doesn't mean that every scientist you meet will have an opinion about plant genetics. What it means is that the experts in the field that have studied this have come to the same conclusion. And these are thousands of independent scientists. So it's similar to climate change. You can still find some scientists, you know, maybe they have a PhD and they'll say, no, you know, I don't believe it. And they'll kind of, who knows, spin off sort of some conspiracy theory. But the majority of the world's climate scientists have reached the same consensus. So that is the kind of, I think, consensus that we need to go through as consumers. So I, of course, as a scientist, I don't understand other fields of science, but like you, because I'm trained as a scientist, I also know that, well, okay, it's a major scientific consensus, so I'm going to go with that. But I think for consumers, sometimes they don't maybe have access to where to find that information. So we try to provide that in the book. And I can say to your listeners that I think the National Academy of Sciences is a very useful place to get information. This is our nation's highest scientific society. And the government also often asks this National Academy of Sciences to write reports on particular issues. And they've done a number of reports on plant genetics and genetic engineering. And they do a fairly good job, at least in the executive summary, explaining in a layperson's terms what the conclusions are. The U.S. Department of Agriculture also puts out information. The American Society of Plant Biologists puts out information. So these are all nonprofit groups. And I think it's important to get information from science-based nonprofit organizations because there's a lot of sort of for-profit or pseudo nonprofit types of organizations that are sometimes they're marketing something that they want to sell by making stories up about something else. So it can be very challenging for the consumer. And of course, you're very familiar with this working in food and nutrition. It can be very, very challenging to get science-based information. So as scientists, I think we must do a better job with that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. All great points. Thank you. Your TED Talk, I'll link to that and all the information about you in my show notes at soundbitesrd.com. But I do want to talk about it a little bit because I want them to go watch it. But at the same time, I want them to understand what your focus was and what you were sharing. So what I took away from it is that you shared some really specific examples of how genetic engineering can be used to fight pests and disease and reduce the amount of insecticides and also reduce malnutrition. So without repeating the TED Talk or going too far down any one of those paths, can you talk a little bit about that so that the listener understands?
Yeah. So what I did in the TED Talks, I gave specific examples because in a sense, it doesn't even matter if you understand the process of genetic engineering. What matters is that you understand what the plant is and why it's genetically engineered. So I gave a couple examples. So one example is the papaya. So this is a very important crop in Hawaii. And in the 1950s, there was a very devastating virus that infected the papaya, and there was no way to control the disease. There was no organic method, no breeding method, nothing you could spray. And so the papaya farmers moved to another island, but eventually the virus moved to that other island. But it's a really nice story because there was a local Hawaiian, a plant pathologist named Dennis Gonzalez, decided to try to address this challenge by using genetic engineering, which when he started this work was quite new. And he took a snippet of DNA from a mild strain of the virus and engineered it into the plant. And it's conceptually similar, although mechanistically different than a vaccination. So it turned out that the plants that he developed were completely resistant to viral infection. And they've been grown for more than 20 years in Hawaii. And 20 years later, there's still no other method to control that disease. So this is a very powerful example, I think. And I like to point out that it's nonprofit. People get very emotional when private companies such as Monsanto are involved in the discussion. And so I think it's really important to point out this is a a government-funded project. It was for growers in Hawaii that have very small plots. It's a very important fruit to people in Hawaii. And I also like to mention that, sometimes people think, oh my gosh, a little bit of viral DNA, I don't want that. I want my food to be clean and pure, is sort of this idea of pure food. But if you think about it, if you bite into a genetically engineered papaya, you're chewing on just a trace amount of viral protein. But if you bite into an organic papaya or a conventional papaya that's infected with the virus, you're chewing on 10 times more protein. So there's not even any sort of scientific or logical basis that you could even imagine that genetically engineered crop would be more harmful to you than another papaya. And so I like to give the whole story because I think it's really helpful. When we talk about genetic engineering and genetics, it starts to become a little bit foggy because not everybody is familiar with DNA and that type of work. But most people have bitten into a papaya.
Mm-hmm. Right. And as you said, I mean, that's a very important fruit to Hawaii, whereas, we have citrus greening and some sort of issue with bananas. I mean, if oranges or bananas were to go away in the United States, it would be devastating, and I know that, I think that there are some genetic opportunities to help protect those fruits as well. Maybe you can speak to that. Maybe that's beyond the scope of the interview.
Your point is really very good. There are many diseases of crops that are very, very challenging. And so disease is not sort of a static thing that we either have them or we don't. They change over time and over geographic regions. And with climate change, they're predicted to change even more rapidly. And there are currently a number of diseases that are really problematic, both for people in less developed countries, such as banana wilt disease. There's viruses that infect cassava, which is a staple fruit. Sorry, cassava is a staple for people in many parts of the world. And so there are scientists trying to develop methods to control those diseases. And when there's a disease problem, scientists use all types of approaches. They will try sort of what we consider as manual approaches, clean your machete so you're not transferring the disease. We consider things like classical breeding. Of course, people try different types of chemicals. People will try sort of biocontrol strategies. They'll try genetic engineering. So what I think is really helpful is if you have many scientists working on that problem, and hopefully one approach will be useful and appropriate and safe and cheap for farmers to use.
Right. So that brings me back to how you would like to be known as the pro-sustainable ag person. And I love that because I think it really does get back to the heart of your work and the book. And it's almost like taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture. I think, sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees and we're like conventional versus organic. And this concept of by looking at all the tools available, what can make things more sustainable? What is better for the environment? I talk a lot about trade-offs with some of my guests because I think, you know, we tend to think of something sustainable or it's not, when actually there's a spectrum. Is this more sustainable now than it was before? How can we kind of keep moving in that direction? So can you talk a little bit more about that pro-sustainable ag and how that all kind of comes together in your book with plant genetics and organic and all the other tools that can help, you know, drive innovation and solutions?
Sure. So farming is a complex system, and every farmer has their own challenges depending on where they live and what crop they grow. And so what, you know, most farmers already do, whether you're an organic farmer or a conventional farmer, is they try to consider ways to reduce pest outbreaks, disease outbreaks. They consider ways to foster soil fertility. Most farmers rotate crops, for example. That's kind of one very practical and very powerful approach to controlling disease, because if you grow the same crop on the same piece of land year after year after year, you could start to build up different types of disease problems or pest problems. So that's sort of a practical approach, rotating your crop. So one year you might grow broccoli, another year you might grow potato, or in the Midwest where they, in California, we grow 350 different types of fruits and vegetables. It's a very different sort of situation in the Midwest. They have fewer crops, much greater land devoted to those crops, but they also do rotating. Common rotation is soybean and corn. Soybean is able to form a symbiotic association with a soil bacteria, which allows the plant to fix nitrogen from the air. So it helps to maintain soil fertility. So that's one reason farmers will rotate their crops. So this is just kind of an example of a, you know, practical approach to farming that's really important. But farmers also rely on seed varieties. So they, well, there's many varieties usually for a particular seed, and farmers are often very interested in planting a seed that has a gene incorporated that confers resistance to a particular disease. And typically that gene is not incorporated using genetic engineering. Typically it's been introduced through a conventional breeding approach, and farmers have been planting varieties with genes from even other species for more than 100 years. So it's a really powerful, seed is a really powerful and economically and environmentally effective approach for controlling disease. Because if the seed has genes for resistance, the pest or pathogen typically can't infect that crop, at least hopefully not that season. So it's a combination of approaches. And I think, you know, most farmers, I've never met a farmer that doesn't know this, but it's really, I think, uncommon for people that are outside of farming to perhaps understand that farmers are using these different types of approaches, because most of us aren't farmers. I think it's like maybe 1-2% of all of us in the United States actually are farmers. So we're very removed from the farm, and some of the approaches that farmers are using perhaps are not always so well known.
Well, that brings me to a question, because I worry about this a lot. I'll say I lose sleep over this sometimes. Is, do you worry that consumer misunderstanding and lack of knowledge, or just being so far removed from the farm, yet having a voice about and an opinion about how farming should be done, do you worry that that has and will impact farmer choices? Because that's what I worry about.
Well, I think it's already happening a bit. I mean, I have to say dialogue is very, very important. And, you know, farmers need to hear from consumers, obviously. But I think a dialogue is important, like an engagement with the consumer concerns, with talking to the farmer or going to their farm. That is really important. Unfortunately, we are already seeing a number of sort of disquieting trends from the point of view of someone interested in sustainable agriculture. So as you know, there's sort of this proliferation of absence labels, labels that say what's not in the food, and they're used for marketing. And one of the really astounding one is non-GMO labels. They've really increased on food packaging. You can find them on water, on salt, neither of which contain DNA. So it's used sort of as marketing, and consumers are beginning to think that there's something beneficial about that label, and they're starting to request it from farmers. And there's been a number of stories on National Public Radio. In our new edition of our book, I tell a story related to this. But what's happening is consumers are demanding something be labeled non-GMO, which often means that they'll go back to using older and more toxic herbicides and insecticides. And that's a problem for everyone. It's a problem for the consumer because they're really not getting what they think they're getting. So a lot of people think, oh, GMO must be sort of bad, must be some kind of chemical, so I'll buy non-GMO. But often that non-GMO corn, for example, that you're buying, or soybean, has actually been used using older and more toxic chemicals, because the non-GMO label is not an organic label. It doesn't mean the farmer is growing their crops organically. And here in California, we have a important alfalfa crop because we also have a lot of dairy. And in the past, there's been some pretty harmful types of herbicide used in alfalfa fields to control weeds. So the classic is paraquat, used to control weeds. But then there was a genetically engineered herbicide tolerant crop that was developed and allowed farmers to reduce the number of sprays and to reduce the toxicity of that herbicide. But unfortunately, consumers don't know that. So they're asking for non-GMO. Now they're going back to asking for non-GMO alfalfa. So growers have to go back to these very toxic approaches that they were using in the past. So that's kind of an example that's spreading. And so we are seeing that.
Okay. Yeah. So there's sort of a paradox there, which I want to talk about, but I just retweeted a tweet that you posted, a usnews.com article, Stop the Food Label Fear Mongering. So I'll put that in my show notes too. It's all about the absence claims. And, you know, I think back to, you know, when vegetable oil would say cholesterol free and it would drive dietitians nuts. I mean, that's so benign compared to where we are today when, okay, so maybe people were like, oh, good, I'll have this vegetable oil. You know, well, no cholesterol, never had it, never will. But the types of examples we're seeing now, like you said, like non-GMO, it must be better. Now, you had said non-GMO doesn't mean organic, but an organic label technically is non-GMO. Is that correct?
Well, of course, and that's where it's just so confusing. An organic label doesn't mean that genetics is not used. And in fact, the organic label accepts many types of genetics, like random mutagenesis, where seeds are soaked in chemicals or they're irradiated and there's random genetic changes. They accept grafting, where you put two different species together. They accept different types of hybrids, where it's a very controlled genetic experiment that you develop hybrid seed that are sold by major seed companies. But it does not allow, for example, BT sweet corn. So organic farmers spray BT on their crops to control pests. And they're allowed to do that, but they're not allowed to plant seed that has the gene for BT in the plant. So it's a very specific kind of designation.
Right. Well, thank you for explaining that. Then that brings me again to this paradox. I think one of the most surprising things that I've seen is wanting things that are better for the environment and wanting to feed the world doesn't seem to be as important to people as I had hoped it would be. Or, well, with the environment aspect, because I did my graduate research on bovine growth hormone in cow's milk, and one of the benefits of that technology was fewer cows, same amount of milk or more milk, and therefore better for the environment. And that was just this. Now, this is back in the early 90s. You know, that was just completely lost on people. Like, they couldn't get past the word hormone into, oh, it's better for the environment. And I think that happens a lot. And in the case of feeding the world, it's like we sort of care, but then if it doesn't affect our immediate life, and I'm using, you know, we and our kind of loosely, because I don't put myself in that category. But those are the things that have shocked me the most, because part of that, yes, is a misunderstanding, but part of that is the whole psychological aspect. So can you speak to that paradox?
I think people really want to support farming practices and make food choices that, of course, are safe for their families and nutritious. And also they are, I think, very interested in helping reduce environmental impacts. But I think what they're not getting is how to put it all together. And so there's so much marketing and false marketing and misinformation. And we, of course, we see a lot of that in the United States now and around the world, that they don't necessarily understand that if you buy milk that was fed non-GMO alfalfa, they don't realize that they're making a choice to spray more paraquat. Mm-hmm. It's not on the label. And that's why the absence labels are problematic. Instead of writing non-GMO alfalfa, it would make be more informative to say this alfalfa was sprayed with paraquat. But the marketers, of course, don't want to do that because then people won't want to buy it. So that's the issue. There's a lot of money in the food industry involved in this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. A lot of, again, kind of brings me back to trade-offs. I know you have to get going soon, but I do want to say, you know, I was kind of stalking you on Twitter recently. I mean, you know, we follow each other, so it's not like, you know, anyone's lurking around. But I noticed that you were using the hashtag Ask Alan Alda, and that reminded me of his book and the interesting work he's doing around science communications. So this was in California, so I'm guessing you were at the conference that he spoke at. So could you share a little bit of that with us?
Yeah, so he came to you. I'm a professor at the University of California, Davis, and we were very fortunate to host Alan Alda here. And last night he gave a wonderful lecture talking about science communication. And so we had the opportunity to meet him, to ask questions, and most people are just very thrilled that he has taken a step into science communication, and he's training scientists how to better communicate their work, which is a real service.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I should say, maybe for those who don't know, Alan Alda is an actor. He was Hawkeye Pierce on the TV series MASH way back in the day. And his book is If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. And what I love about his work is that it's similar to, or I can relate to it, I guess, because I grew up in a theater environment with my dad being an actor, director, playwright. And so I've used those communication skills and experiences in my nutrition and science communication. So I love seeing somebody who's an actor and who does improv with audiences and students kind of using that art and science to better communicate science and helping scientists be better communicators. So I think it's great you were able to see him, and I love the work he's doing. So I'll link to that on my show notes as well. Having said that, can you share with us what you've learned throughout your career with all of your speaking and writing, the book, your research, the work that you do? What have you learned about communicating science to the public?
Well, I think the number one take home from Alan Alda's talk last night was listen. And I think that is very good advice. It's really important to understand where your audience is coming from or where the questions are coming from, and sort of to gauge where are sort of the commonalities. And I think this is what Rel and I, when we first started writing the book, it was, you know, very scientific. This is what farmers do, and this is what geneticists do. And we realized that we had to kind of keep taking a step back to really just explaining why farmers use genetically improved seed. And I think it was really helpful to have a lot of conversations with many different types of people to understand the kinds of things they were thinking about and were interested in learning about. So I think that is really, really good advice to find out where the person you're speaking to, where they are, where their questions are, what is their frame of reference, and then you can have a real engagement rather than just some kind of lecturing.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, I know we didn't have time to get too in-depth into your rice research, but I wanted to share, you know, that your laboratory studies genes that make rice plants tolerant of environmental stress and resistance to disease. And if people want to know more about that, I'll have links to the website. Cropgeneticsinnovation.org is a good one. So I'll have that. And you also co-founded biologyfortified.org, and Kevin Folta is on the board of directors now. So I'll include that as well. And of course, your book talks a lot about your background and your work with rice. And again, I know it's really important, and I'm sorry we didn't have time to get too much into that. But at the end of the day, as we wrap up here, what do you want people to know? What do you want our listeners to know?
I'd like the listeners to engage in science-based information and let us scientists know how we can help with that, because it's not always straightforward when it comes to food and farming.
Mm-hmm. Good. And then we can listen to what it is that they want to know, and then we can try to figure out how to communicate it.
Yes. And thank you for all the work that you do.
My pleasure. A little bit of a labor of love on my end here, and I enjoy interviewing people like you who are doing such great work and giving you a platform to share this information out with my listeners and the rest of the world. So thank you for all the work you do. I look forward to the second edition of your book coming out and keeping up with all of your work. And for everybody listening, as always, enjoy your food with health in mind. Till next time.
For more information, visit soundbitesrd.com. Music by Dave Burke.